Welcome to the Divergent Files podcast. There's a difference between hearing information and feeling something click into place. Before we go any further, let me be clear about one thing. This isn't right-leaning Republican red. This isn't left-leaning Democratic blue. And this is not an attack on teachers, education, or the people trying to do good inside a broken system. This is pro-teacher, pro-truth, anti-bullshit, and above all else, pro-child. Because most teachers aren't the problem. They're doing triage inside a machine they didn't design. And tonight isn't about outrage, blame, or political teams. It's about understanding the system most of us grew up inside without ever being told what it was actually designed to do. This episode isn't fast, and it isn't light, and it isn't meant to make you comfortable. We're not chasing villains. We're not chasing headlines. We're tracing architecture, the quiet kind, the kind you don't notice until you realize you've been living inside it your whole life. I'm Ralph, and this is the Divergent Files podcast. You can feel it, can't you? Something shifted in kids. They think less, they speak softer, they scan the room before they answer, like they're waiting for permission from a ghost you can't see. Kids don't learn that on their own. Someone showed them how. And here's the part no one wants to admit out loud. Our kids didn't magically lose their curiosity. They didn't suddenly wake up one morning allergic to thinking. Someone taught them to shut down. I watched it happen the other day. A kid gets asked the gentlest question in the universe, "What'd you learn in school today?" And he froze like he'd been asked to confess to a crime, eyes darting, shoulders tightening, and then the classic hostage situation answer,
"I don't know."
But he knew. He just didn't know if he was allowed to say it. That wasn't forgetfulness. That was training. And here's what hit me like a brick. That fear in his voice didn't come from home. His parents didn't install that hesitation. That was imported. Imported from the one building he spends most of his day in. The place supposedly built to help him grow. So let me paint you the moment that really punched me in the gut. A kid is sitting on the carpet, working on one of those be creative school projects. You know, the ones that pretend to give kids freedom so they'll forget they're still inside a cage. His mom asks,
"Why'd you pick this topic?"
And the kid answers without blinking,
"Well, because we were told to."
That's it. No spark, no personality, no kid in that answer at all. It was just pure compliance disguised as construction paper. And the worst part, he said it like it was the most normal thing in the world. Like choosing something on his own was a dangerous side quest he'd learned not to attempt. That right there is the betrayal nobody tracks. Someone took a child hardwired for wonder and sanded him down until he fit inside the rubric. And they did it slow, quiet, and surgically. So gentle that his parents never even felt the blade. Trace that pattern backward and you won't land on the teacher in the room. Most teachers are doing triage inside a machine someone else built. You land on the architects, men who died a century ago but somehow still have their hands around your kid's worldview. Tonight, we're pulling their fingerprints. We're digging into the Rockefeller blueprint, the moment education stopped being about learning and started being about control. We're walking straight into the teacher factories, the institutions that decide what an educator is allowed to think before they ever set foot in a classroom. We're lifting the floorboards on the post-war psychology experiments that melted quietly into curriculum like a Trojan horse with a lesson plan. And we're taking a torch to the modern campus machinery. The one that molds entire generations and then pretends the shaping was an accident. Because here's the truth buried under a century of PR. The classroom was never built to teach your child. It was built to shape them. And nobody ever asked parents if they were okay with that. Here's the part everyone tiptoes around like it's radioactive. Education didn't drift into the mess we have today. It didn't modernize. It didn't evolve. Somebody woke up one morning and said, "Hey, what if we stopped raising thinkers and tried raising office furniture instead?" So, no, someone grabbed the wheel. Before the 1900s, your education came from actual human beings with actual emotional attachment to you. Your parents, your neighbors, the blacksmith who taught you what not to touch if you wanted to keep your fingerprints. It was messy. It was imperfect. But it was deeply personal. And the people teaching you had skin in the game. If you screwed up, the correction came from someone who cared whether you lived long enough to use the knowledge. Then the 20th century rolled in, and the industrialists followed right behind it like sharks smelling factory steam. Suddenly, education became the new frontier for philanthropy. Nothing warms a robber baron's heart like pretending he's Santa Claus while buying influence at wholesale prices. Rockefeller, Carnegie, Peabody. Yes, the same men who treated workers like replaceable boats started giving speeches about the future of America's children. Never trust a billionaire who discovers empathy right after discovering the tax code. These guys didn't see children. They saw raw material, untapped human capital, a national resource that needed to be optimized. And instead of asking parents, the people who actually birthed these kids, the industrialists just rewired the entire system by themselves. They centralized curriculum, and sounds harmless, right? "Let's make sure every child learns the same thing," they said. Except when rich men in mahogany boardrooms get to decide what millions of kids read, think, or memorize, that's not curriculum. That's narrative engineering. That's somebody sneaking into a child's inner monologue before they've even learned the alphabet. And here's the truth no one wants to say out loud. The content wasn't the real shift. The content is the wallpaper. The real shift was who owns the building. Look at the receipts. The foundations founded in the early 1900s, Rockefeller, Carnegie, Peabody, all suddenly concerned about literacy while simultaneously pumping money into mining towns, factories, and railroads desperate for compliant workers. You think that's a coincidence? Come on. These men funded reports on shaping national temperament. They wrote publicly about creating efficient citizens. They tested how early you could condition kids to follow identical routines. Folks, this wasn't education. This was early behavioral economics with a chalkboard. And here's the gut punch. Mandatory public schooling didn't rise from a bottom-up demand for educated children. It rose from the boardrooms that needed obedient adults. Parents didn't march on Washington begging for standardized childhoods. Communities didn't design the system. There was no nationwide petition for more bureaucracy and more bells, please. The architects of the system never once hid their goals either. They published them proudly. They described kids as a national asset to be directed. They spoke about public education like a mining operation. So ask yourself this, if the people who built the first mandatory schools thought children were a resource, then what exactly did they think they were building? Because what if the earliest public schools weren't designed for knowledge at all? What if they were designed to mass produce obedience? If that's true, then nothing broken in the system is actually a glitch. It's the blueprint. And tonight? Tonight we're opening it. Rockefeller funding public education isn't the scandal. Rich men have been buying public halos since ancient Rome. If you've got more money than God, charity becomes a hobby, like golf, but with better PR. No, the scandal is what he actually said about children. In 1902, John D. Rockefeller founded something called the General Education Board, the GEB. Sounds official, right? Like a federal department with marble columns and earnest people holding clipboards. But it wasn't. It was a private operation, one man's pet project, a billionaire's side hustle disguised as humanitarian work. And buried in the GEB's own literature, not rumor, not conspiracy, their own words, is the line that should have been on front page newspapers for the next 100 years. Quote, "We shall not try to make these people or any of their children into philosophers or men of learning. We want a class of people who will be content to work their lives away under the direction of others." So read that again. They weren't hiding it. They weren't whispering it. They wrote it down like a mission statement. This wasn't philanthropy. This was industrial scale human husbandry. Rockefeller didn't want thinkers. Thinkers slow down the machine. He wanted workers, standardized, obedient, predictable. Adults who don't question the foreman because they spend childhood learning that asking why gets you a red mark and a stern look. And the GEB wasn't some boutique foundation handing out scholarships. Within a decade, it had wrapped its fingers around almost every major teacher training college in the country. If you controlled the teachers, you controlled the kids. Why waste time shaping the product when you can reprogram the factory? So, they called it teacher training. Real cute. But it was curriculum laundering. Teachers went in with curiosity. They came out with a script. Because here's the thing Rockefeller understood better than most. If you want to steer a society, you don't need to touch the children. You engineer the adults they learn from. Teachers became the delivery system. The GEB was the operating system. And the receipts are everywhere. GEB charters archived in government libraries. Congressional hearings where nobody bothered to ask the obvious questions. Rockefeller Foundation annual reports bragging about efficiency improvements in rural schools. Efficiency? When a billionaire says efficiency, hold on to your wallet and your children. Now, follow the money trail and you start seeing the shape of the machine. The GEB didn't just fund schools. It funded publishing houses, testing bureaus, curriculum labs. It created the conditions for textbook monopolies like McGraw-Hill, Holt, Prentice Hall, the companies that quietly decided what every American child would read. Before the GEB, textbooks varied by region. After the GEB, everyone read from the same script. One voice, one narrative, one worldview calibrated for minimum friction. Don't call it education. Call it consensus manufacturing. You don't get innovation out of a system like that. You get well-behaved employees who believe the rules are older than the sky. And who did Rockefeller target first? Well, not the elite private schools, not Yale, not Phillips, not the kids of the boardroom class. He aimed straight at rural America, immigrant communities, the working poor, the people least likely to push back and the easiest to reshape. If you mold the base layer of society, the structure above it will never wobble. Even the phrase education reform was just a Trojan horse. Because who's against reform? It's like being against oxygen. But inside that Trojan horse was a worldview, engineered, deliberate, and tailor-made for an industrial empire that needed compliant hands more than circus minds. So let's say it out loud. Rockefeller used his wealth to build a privately run shadow system that designed teacher colleges, standardized curriculum, engineered testing regimes, controlled textbook supply, rewired the definition of a good student. And people clapped for it. They thanked him. If you were trying to build a society where obedience is seen as intelligence, where compliance is seen as maturity, and where the highest virtue is showing up on time and not asking questions, you'd build exactly this. That's the part nobody talks about. The battle for children never began in the classroom. It began in the teacher factories. By the time the bell rang, the shaping was already finished. Most parents think the curriculum comes from some friendly committee of wise educators with warm sweaters and gentle smiles. Yeah, no. The people who built the skeleton of American schooling were not Mr. Rogers with a chalkboard. They were social engineers with God complexes, and they've been dead for decades. But their fingerprints are still on every worksheet your kid drags home. If you really want to understand why modern classrooms feel like obedience boot camps, you have to go back to the original architects. And trust me, these men didn't see your child as a tiny human full of potential. They saw a raw material, a thing, a problem to be optimized for whatever society they wanted. Let's start with John Dewey, America's educator saint, who, if we're being honest, behaved more like a polite philosopher king designing a civilization from his armchair. Dewey taught at Columbia Teachers College, the mothership of teacher training, and he wasn't subtle about his goals. In Democracy and Education, he drops the mask and says the quiet part almost out loud. Schools should shape behavior, not just teach facts, shape citizens. Which sounds noble until you read between the lines and realize what he meant. We need kids who go along with the group, not kids who ask annoying questions that slow the machine down. Dewey didn't want kids thinking for themselves. He wanted them thinking about society in a way that served the collective. A classroom wasn't a place to grow individuality. It was a political sandbox, a conditioning chamber. Then there's Edward Thorndike, Dewey's buddy, the godfather of behaviorism, and the man who looked at a classroom and basically saw a chicken coop with better lighting. Thorndike was obsessed with measurement. If it couldn't be scored, he didn't think it was real. He believed intelligence was fixed, like shoe size, and that children could be sorted on a conveyor belt. The Carnegie Foundation loved this idea so much that they funded his experiments like he was building the next Model T. His worldview became the backbone of early IQ testing, the moment when gifted became a golden ticket and everyone else got politely shoved aside with a sad sticker and a lower expectation. Thorndike didn't care about curiosity. Curiosity is messy. He cared about compliance. Compliance scales better. And while Thorndike was turning kids into data points, his colleagues in psychology were busy training dogs to salivate on command. Pavlov's dogs didn't know it, but they were writing the early drafts of every classroom behavioral chart in America. Then B.F. Skinner entered the chat and turned everything into a stimulus response circus. Push button, get reward. Don't push it, fail quietly. He didn't even pretend school was about curiosity. It was about conditioning. At this point, education had officially turned into a lab experiment with nicer lighting and fewer chew toys. And what happened to subjects like psychology, philosophy, logic, and rhetoric, the stuff that actually teaches kids how to think instead of what to think? Well, they were quietly murdered. Cut from curriculum starting in the 1910s because they were too abstract, too slow, and here's my favorite, too hard to standardize. Translation, we can't score it, so throw it out. By the 1930s, textbook revisions reflected the new regime. School wasn't about forming minds. It was about streamlining them, narrowing the lanes, filtering out kids who didn't respond well to the lab rat treatment. Education stopped being a garden and became a sorting facility, a quiet factory for manufacturing compliant adults. And the worst part? They succeeded. Generations grew up believing obedience was intelligence, that raising your hand was a moral virtue, that waiting for the bell was normal. that there was always a rubric, that the world makes sense if you follow the directions printed on the handout. And when the real world didn't give them directions, they froze because the system never taught them how to think, only how to perform. This wasn't schooling. It was industrial behavior management. The architecture of a society that wanted predictability more than potential. And all of it traces back to a handful of intellectuals who never met your kid, never cared about their mind, and never asked who they might become if left unshaped. Because these men didn't care what children could learn. They cared what children were for. And that was the design. And we're still living inside it. Have you ever wondered why every standardized test feels like it was designed by a committee of bored vampires who haven't met a real child in 200 years? Well, it's because they were. And no, not actual vampires, but just people who drained the life out of anything curious or human. Everything your kid is forced to bubble in today traces back to a handful of boardrooms run by executives who haven't taught a day in their lives, but somehow get to decide what intelligence looks like. Let's go back to where this circus all began. During World War I, the Army rolled out the Army Alpha Test, humanity's first attempt at sorting millions of young men into neat little piles. Useful. Kinda useful. Eh. And please don't hand him anything sharp. The questions were a joke. Is a violin a musical instrument? What season do gentlemen go fox hunting? Yeah. Real salt of the earth stuff. If you grew up poor, immigrant, not a fan of chasing rich rodents with rich friends, too bad. The test decided you were slow. And here's the tragic comedy. The war ended, but the test did not. They just repackaged it. Suddenly, the entire country caught IQ fever, and your kid's future could be decided by whether they circled yes on a question some Ivy League anthropologist wrote while smoking a pipe and daydreaming about eugenics. But then things got worse. Enter ETS, the Educational Testing Service. Formed in the 1940s, marketed as a nonprofit, but operating like a cartel with better lighting. ETS birthed the SAT, the GRE. Half the alphabet soup your kid is forced to swallow. They claimed it was about measuring potential. Meanwhile, every school in the country quietly learned the truth. If you wanted federal funding, you bent the knee. You aligned your curriculum. You taught the test. You swallowed whatever standards ETS vomited onto the table. If your students didn't do well, your school got punished. Your teachers got punished. Your district got punished. Nothing motivates compliance like the threat of defunding children. This is the moment when curriculum stopped being a guide and started acting like a legal code. Teaching stopped being creative. It became clerical. What benchmark are we hitting today? What bubble pattern gets us the points? What answer will avoid an audit? Kids weren't learning anything real. They were learning how to navigate a bureaucratic obstacle course built by people who will never meet them. And while everyone was staring at the tests, the textbook giants locked the gates behind them. McGraw-Hill, Pearson, Houghton Mifflin, Harcourt. These companies didn't win because they wrote good books. They won because they tailored themselves to federal standards like a bespoke suit. They didn't just print the curriculum. They wrote the curriculum. Then they lobbied to have it adopted. Then they sold it back to school districts at a markup that would make a loan shark blush. If you think that sounds like a conflict of interest, don't. It wasn't a conflict. It was the business model. Then came the Texas textbook hearings, the moment the country accidentally discovered how bad it really was. Parents, teachers, and activists learned that school boards weren't just choosing books. They were rewriting history inside them, deleting events, softening language, massaging narratives until they were safe enough to sell. And because Texas has the buying power of a small nation, whatever they approved became the default for states that had no say in the matter. Kids in Oregon ended up learning history the way Texas wanted it told. Meanwhile, the NAEP, the National Assessment of Educational Progress, crafted a scoring framework so rigid it might as well have been etched into a tombstone. Teachers stopped teaching the world. They taught the rubric. They taught the format. They taught just how to survive. And not because they were lazy, because they were threatened. Their job security, their school's existence, their entire profession was tied to whether 9-year-olds could correctly guess what a committee 1,000 miles away wanted them to say about a paragraph they didn't care about. And here's the punchline that should make every parent's stomach drop. Standardized testing wasn't designed to measure learning. It was designed to enforce learning. Enforce what counts as knowledge. Enforce who gets labeled smart. Enforce who moves up, who moves sideways, and who we quietly allow to fall through the cracks. If your kid doesn't test well, doesn't mean they're slow. It means the machine wasn't built for them. Because it wasn't built for kids, period. It was built for scale, for efficiency, for silence, for a system that needs predictable outputs more than it needs curious humans. And the moment we let testing bureaus and publisher cartels define what learning is, we stopped asking what a child could become and started asking how quickly they could be processed. Welcome to the factory floor. If you think the wildest MKUltra experiments happen in some hidden bunker under the desert, surrounded by steel doors and guys with no last names, well, I've got news for you. The creepiest stuff happened on college campuses, in daylight, in buildings with nice landscaping and overpriced bookstores. Right after World War II, the CIA had a realization, and it wasn't subtle. Why fight for control of every classroom when you can just control the people who train every teacher? It's efficiency, like mind control Costco. So, from the 1940s through the 1970s, elite universities like Harvard, Stanford, Columbia, McGill became playgrounds for psychological experiments that would make a horror writer tap out. And they weren't studying how to improve learning. They were studying how to direct learning, to shape it, condition it. Not education, compliance training. And here's the part that nobody thinks about. These researchers didn't disappear into shame after MKUltra collapsed. They didn't go on the run. They weren't fired. They got promoted. They got tenure. They even wrote books. They chaired entire departments of education. So imagine finding out the guy who spent a decade trying to erase human memory now runs the committee deciding how teachers should be trained. Welcome to post-war academia. By the 1960s, teacher colleges were quietly absorbing behaviorist doctrine like a sponge. B.F. Skinner's push-button, get-reward teaching model spread faster than rumors in a dorm building. Kids weren't being taught to think. They were being taught just to respond, like dogs with backpacks. And the government? Well, they made sure the reward system extended to the schools themselves. The 1963 National Defense Education Act wrapped a patriotic bow around the whole thing. Sputnik freaked everyone out. So, Washington threw money at education, but only if schools aligned their curriculum with federal goals. Translation? You want that sweet funding? Teach what we approve. Train teachers how we say. Smile while signing. Psych departments became curriculum factories. Teacher programs became ideology funnels. Behavior modification, the same stuff tested in MKUltra, became classroom best practices. And the whole thing was sold as progress. That's the part that stings. They didn't say, we're optimizing your child for compliance. They said, we're modernizing education. They didn't say we're studying how to implant ideas. No, they said we're improving outcomes. They didn't say we're reorganizing the human mind. They said we're helping. Here's the uncomfortable truth. The government didn't need to brainwash kids. They trained the people who would. And those people, the ones shaped by MKUltra era psychology, Cold War fear, and federal funding strings, they didn't retire. They trained the next wave. And that wave trained the next. Layers on layers, a generational relay race most parents never noticed because it all looked so official. These people still run departments. They still approve curriculum. They still gatekeep teaching licenses, still shape the worldview of everyone who steps into a classroom. That's the legacy of MKUltra. Not broke minds in secret clinics, but well-educated professionals who think the line between guiding a student and steering a citizen is paper thin. And when you control the people who shape the teachers, you never have to touch the children. They'll be shaped automatically, downstream, quietly, and predictably. And best of all, no one ever sees the hands on the controls. Let me ask you something you've probably felt in your bones but never had the language for. When did schools stop teaching kids how to think and start teaching them what to think? Not the obvious stuff, not reading or math or don't eat the glue. I mean worldview, identity. This weird sense that the classroom isn't a place to learn anymore. It's a place to get aligned. And here's the part nobody ever says out loud. This didn't start with your school board fighting about today's buzzwords. This didn't begin with CRT or gender debates or whatever's trending this week. Those are symptoms, surface noise. The real shift started long before any of us were alive, in a country collapsing under its own weight, in a classroom full of bitter intellectuals, wondering why the revolution never came. So Germany, 1920s, the Frankfurt School. A group of theorists looked around and basically said, okay, the workers didn't rise up, so maybe Marx was wrong, or maybe we're looking at the wrong battlefield. They decided the real engine of society wasn't the economy, it was culture, tradition, family, religion, national identity. All the things that make people feel anchored. To them, these weren't stabilizing forces. They were obstacles. If you want a new society, you have to reshape the stories people tell themselves. And to reshape the stories, you go to the story factory, the schools, the universities, the cultural centers. And you don't go there with a gun, but with a chalkboard. Then Hitler came to power. The Frankfurt scholars fled, and America, wide open, idealistic, and completely unprepared, welcomed them straight into its universities. Columbia, Chicago, Berkeley, Brandeis. Departments that had taught logic, rhetoric, and inquiry suddenly found themselves hosting thinkers who believed the job of education wasn't to reveal truth, but to challenge the idea that truth even exists. Their weapon was something called critical theory. And let's be clear, this wasn't critical thinking, the thing your English teacher preached. Critical theory is different. It doesn't ask, is this true? It asks, who does this serve? Under that lens, everything becomes a system of power. Every tradition becomes oppression in disguise. Every disagreement becomes harm. And every student learns that the world is a map of victims and villains, and someone already labeled everyone for them. By the 1960s, this framework had leaked into the curriculum without anyone voting on it. The Berkeley Free Speech Movement, a movement and a moment that should have been a celebration of open debate, ironically became the fuse for the worldview that later decided certain speech doesn't deserve to exist at all. Because once you convince people that speech can equal violence, you never have to argue with them again. You can just shut the conversation down. So slowly, the old model of education, the one based on curiosity and debate, got pushed into the hallway like a substitute teacher no one respects. In its place came identity-first teaching, grievance-first analysis, worldview as homework. And here's the twist most people miss. This wasn't spreading through classrooms first. It spread through administration, the world of committees, HR bureaus, and campus offices that live several floors above the people they control. DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, did not start as an ideology. It started as a legal compliance office, a human shield against lawsuits. But it grew. Every year, it added staff. Every year, it added responsibilities. And at some point, without any public debate, DEI stopped being paperwork and became a worldview. Then came the teacher colleges. These places used to teach classroom management, subject mastery, basic pedagogy. Now, you can fail a program for not embracing the right ideological frameworks. You can lose your teaching license for refusing to embed approved lenses into your lesson plans. They don't need to ban a teacher for thinking differently. They just never let them graduate. And professors who spoke up, gently, politely, and cautiously, found themselves quietly removed. Not fired, just gone. Emails ignored. Tenure votes stalled. Names that used to be on the faculty directory suddenly weren't. Not a purge, a filtration. That's the real move. You don't have to change the classroom if you control the pipeline. You don't have to fight the teacher if you decide who gets to be a teacher. And by the time your kid sits down at their desk on a random Tuesday morning, the worldview is already baked, packaged, and delivered long before the morning bell rings. So kids don't inherit facts. They inherit frameworks. And the saddest part? Most of them will never know there was another way to see the world. The funny thing about DEI is that everyone argues about what it is today, but nobody ever asks what it started as. Because if people knew the original job of a DEI office, they'd laugh. Its job wasn't activism or ideology or even rewriting society. Its job was paperwork, a big filing cabinet whose entire purpose was make sure the university doesn't get sued. That was DEI at the beginning, the office of please don't bankrupt us. Then something strange happened. A filing cabinet grew teeth. Back in the late 1960s and 70s, universities realized they needed compliance officers to follow new civil rights laws. And those early offices were boring, like painfully boring. Think laminated posters, dull training slides, and a guy named Dennis who wore beige everything. But slowly the office started to mutate. Not because anyone voted on it, not because students demanded it, because universities discovered a cheat code. If you control what counts as inclusive, you control what counts as acceptable thought. And they leaned into that power like it was a new drug. By the 90s, DEI wasn't in the basement anymore. It had its own building. And suddenly, its job wasn't just making sure nobody discriminated. Its job was defining what discrimination even meant. So this is where things got bold. DEI started acting like a shadow administrative branch. It didn't write laws. It wrote rules, internal ones, quiet ones. If a professor wanted tenure, DEI had an opinion. If a department wanted funding, DEI had input. If a curriculum needed updating, DEI had a whole list of things it expected to see. No one elected them, no one debated them, but everyone listened. Because schools learned the hard way. DEI doesn't need force, it has leverage. Then the teacher training programs got folded in. That's the part everyone underestimates. While parents were busy arguing about math textbooks, the real battle was happening in the education schools. The places that make the teachers. So you want a teaching license in most states today? Well, you better speak the language. And I don't mean English. I mean ideological fluency. You fill out reflection journals. You write positionality statements. You promise alignment. You declare your lens. And if you don't, good luck teaching anything more complex than a bake sale. This is how DEI became the gatekeeper for the entire pipeline. Teachers don't walk into classrooms blank slates. They walk in preloaded. They've been trained to teach not subjects, but frameworks. And the frameworks match the worldview of the office that signs their paperwork. And the hiring committees? Oh man, that's where the real comedy begins. Universities started requiring diversity statements. Not diversity of thought, no, diversity of confession. Applicants had to explain how they would advance the mission being whatever DEI said it was that year. Some of these statements read like small novels. People writing page after page about how very, very committed they are, almost as if someone's watching from behind the curtain, because they are. And here's the part that always gets buried. DEI doesn't censor professors. DEI just makes sure the wrong kind never get hired to begin with. No firing needed, no scandal, no debate. Just a hiring pool full of people who already think the same way. And by the time students show up, the game is already in motion. The worldview is baked in. The framework is preloaded. The institution is wearing its favorite mask, the one that says, "We're helping." Kids think they're learning. Teachers think they're teaching. But what's really happening is alignment. Smooth, polished, frictionless alignment. Not because there's a smoky backroom cabal, but because DEI figured out the golden rule of influence, which is, you don't have to control the classroom. You just have to control the people who get to walk into it. And once you do that, everything else falls in line without a fight. That's the real story. Not the arguments on cable news, not the angry school board meetings. The real story is upstream, in the offices nobody visits, writing rules nobody voted on, shaping the worldview of people who shape the worldview of kids. It wasn't a takeover of education. It was a takeover of the architects. And the worldview? It arrives long before the lesson plan ever does. So let's forget the memes and the culture war shouting matches. Those are just the fireworks. They're pretty loud and designed to distract you. The real mechanism is quieter, stranger, cleaner, and way, way more efficient. Because the modern classroom doesn't need to yell to shape a child. It just nudges and nudges and nudges until the kid stops realizing they're even being moved. This is the algorithm of influence, and it's baked into daily routine. So start with the easiest lever, social conformity. Kids don't want to be right. They want to belong. Which means the fastest way to control thought is to hint, just hint, at what the group believes. A raised eyebrow during discussion, a loaded question, a preferred answer hidden in the rubric. You don't have to teach ideology directly. You just reward the kids who echo the correct lines and let silence punish the ones who don't. The next lever, grading pressure. You'd be amazed how fast a teenager will adjust their worldview if it means avoiding a C-. The modern grading system isn't about knowledge. It's a behavioral reward loop. You get in line, get the grade. Ask the wrong question, enjoy your trip to academic purgatory. Then comes the emotional framing. Schools don't debate ideas anymore. They moralize them. Everything has a correct emotional tone now. If you question a premise, it's not wrong, it's harmful. The second you attach guilt to an idea, you don't need argument. You've already won. And the textbooks? Forget the old 5-year publishing cycle. Now it's annual updates. Digital editions rewritten overnight. Interpretations shift with the political breeze, and teachers are told, just keep up. It's not education, it's software patching. Dissenting teachers? Please. They get eaten alive. I've seen real teacher manuals, whole sections dedicated to maintaining alignment with district values. That's corporate speak for don't step out of line. You can be brilliant, compassionate, and adored by students and still lose your job for deviating from the pre-approved worldview of a committee you'll never meet. Students see that and they learn faster than you think. Not the curriculum, the risk. They learn to self-censor, to give the safe answer, to pretend they agree so they don't get singled out. It's survival, not education. And here's the trapdoor. You could delete every controversial buzzword, CRT, DEI, gender theory, all of it, and the machine would still work because the mechanism isn't the ideology, it's the structure. A structure built to reward conformity, punish deviation, and turn kids into perfect little performers of the approved truth. That's the modern machine, and we're just getting started. Every intelligence agency on earth lives by one rule. If you shape the children, you never have to control the adults. Because adults argue, adults question, adults remember what life looked like before the rules changed. But kids? Kids can be taught the new normal before they even realize there was an old one. That's why governments love education systems, not the learning part, the imprinting part. So let's start with DARPA, our favorite agency, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agencies. These are the people who invented drones, GPS, and half the things that make sci-fi feel old. So what's DARPA researching now? Something called cognitive warfare. Their words, not mine. Look at their broad agency announcements, the BAA documents. Buried inside are programs explicitly studying belief formation, narrative capture, and how to shape preconscious decision pathways. Translated, how to steer someone's worldview before they know they even have one. Then there's RAND, the think tank every administration swears they don't use, but somehow their fingerprints end up on every policy memo anyway. RAND has entire studies on what they call pre-ideological imprinting. That's just a fancy way of saying, catch them young enough and you set the boundaries of what they'll consider reasonable truth for the rest of their life. So now, if your stomach hasn't dropped yet, let's keep going. Because the CIA has declassified psychological operations manuals that read like user guides for influencing children. Not teenagers, children. In these manuals, they talk about the importance of shaping impressions during early developmental stages because adults rarely undo their childhood programming. If you can get to someone before puberty, you don't need propaganda later. The worldview cements itself. And you think it stops there? Oh, please. The Pentagon's human terrain system used anthropologists, actual PhDs in culture, to map how people think, react, and bond inside communities. Those programs were created for foreign populations and then quietly repurposed for domestic influence operations. Who decides what kids learn about identity, power, freedom, morality, and authority? Well, it's not the teachers, and sure, not the parents. It's committees you'll never meet, influenced by institutions you did not vote for, using psychological frameworks you've never been shown. And if you really want to understand the scale, look at the UN's Education for Sustainable Development Guidelines. It's not reading. It's not math. It's worldview training, global citizenship, ideological alignment, approved interpretations of history and society. Not taught as opinion, taught as baseline truth. This isn't politics. This is strategy. Governments don't fight for your vote. They fight for your child's default settings. Because once you decide what a child believes is normal, you don't need to control the child as an adult. They'll just control themselves. And they'll call it being a good citizen. This, all of this, is the state's dream. And that's the machine you were never supposed to see. Before we go any further, let's slow down for a minute. Let's take a breath. Let's shake the adrenaline out of your hands. Because I know how this kind of episode gets twisted. Some people hear anything critical about education and instantly scream, "Oh, you must be right wing." Others hear anything critical about government power and yell, "Oh, you're pushing left wing paranoia." We're not playing for either of your teams. We don't even want the jerseys. This isn't a political rant. This isn't some culture war sermon. This is a receipts-driven autopsy on a system that shapes children long before they have language for what's happening to them. And if you want to know where we stand, it's quite simple. We are pro-child, pro-truth, pro-teacher, and absolutely anti-bullshit. This is not an attack on teachers, not even close. Most teachers are the only reason the whole machine hasn't collapsed into a flaming crater. Good teachers fight the system every single day, quietly, creatively, and usually without credit. They smuggle honesty into locked curricula. They protect kids from bureaucratic nonsense. They care in ways the system absolutely does not. Teachers aren't the villains here. They're the ones doing damage control inside a room someone else wired with explosives. And look, there are multiple viewpoints on everything we've talked about so far. There are reforms that were well-intentioned. There are policies created by people genuinely trying to help. There are educators and academics who acted in good faith even when the ideas turned out sideways. But good intentions don't fix bad design. And bad design isn't what we're following like detectives tracing a blood trail. Because this isn't emotional. This isn't partisan. This is structural. It doesn't matter whether the people in charge meant well or meant harm. The outcome is the same. A system that rewards conformity over curiosity. A system that punishes dissent, whether you lean left, right, or you're just trying to keep your kid's mind intact. A system that doesn't care who you voted for, as long as you follow the script. And that's why we're not pointing fingers at individuals. We're tracing institutional power, the kind that survives presidents, survives elections, culture wars, and trending hashtags. That's the only thing that matters here. You don't need a villain to see a design. Sometimes the architecture speaks for itself. So let's center ourselves. Not the system, not the noise, not the outrage machine that tries to drag every conversation into red versus blue. Just us. You and me. And that kid from the beginning of this video. The one who paused before he answered because someone taught him to be afraid of the wrong words. I keep thinking about him. And not because he did anything wrong, but because he did everything the system rewards. He hesitated. He checked the air. He hid the real answer. And that's the part that sits heavy on my chest. The idea that a child can learn to fear their own thoughts before they even learn multiplication. No parent on earth wants that. No teacher worth their paycheck wants that. No decent human being wants that. This isn't left. This isn't right. This is basic sanity. A system that shapes the mind of a child without their parents' permission, without the child's awareness, without any honest accountability. That kind of system is dangerous. It's garbage. No matter who runs it. No matter what the slogans say, no matter which team claims to fix it. Because shaping information is one thing. Shaping interpretation is another. But shaping identity, quietly, professionally, algorithmically, that's where the ground starts to tilt under our feet. And the real nightmare isn't that someone wants your kid to think a certain way. It's that your kid might grow up thinking they arrived at those beliefs all on their own. That's the real theft. Not the curriculum, not the textbooks, not even the tests. The sense of ownership over their own mind. I think about that mom asking her son why he chose his project. I think about the way he answered. I think about how normal it felt to him, And I wonder, at what point do we stop recognizing the shaping? At what point do the lines blur so slowly we forget there were lines at all? Because if there's one truth buried under every receipt we've pulled tonight, it's this. If they can shape what the next generation thinks, they can shape what the future remembers. And once you can edit memory, collective or individual, you don't need to control people. They'll walk the path you wanted and call it their own. If you made it this far, thank you for sitting in the dark with me. Not the political dark, that's loud and stupid and sponsored by people who can't even spell nuance. I mean the real dark, the one where you start asking the questions the system quietly hopes you never do. Because tonight wasn't about picking a side. It wasn't about blaming teachers or parents or whichever political mascot you like to scream at on the internet. This was about something much older, something much deeper. A blueprint that was laid down long before any of us got here. And now that you've seen it, you can't unsee it. The truth is simple. Kids deserve real education, not manufactured obedience. They deserve curiosity, not calibration. They deserve adults who fight for their minds, not people who treat those minds like blank hard drives ready for ideological firmware updates. And if that makes us the odd ones out, fine. I've never minded being the weird kid in the room asking the one question everyone else avoided. I'm not here to recruit you into anyone's team. I'm here because the truth matters, especially when it's inconvenient, especially when it cuts across the grain, and especially when it involves kids who don't even know what's being done in their name. And if this episode hit you the way it hit me while I was making it, then you understand why we can't stop here, and we won't. Because we've traced part of the machine, but not all of it. And the next piece? Oh, it's hiding in plain sight. The universities. The secret architecture that decides who gets to shape the next generation and who gets quietly filtered out before they ever reach a classroom. Oh yes, we're going there very soon. If you're still here, you're one of us now. I'm Ralph, and this is Divergent Files. I make these alone at night, after the day job, and after my son goes to sleep. And if you want to help keep this channel alive, you can support it over at patreon.com/divergentfiles. Until next time, stay curious, stay grounded, and remember, no matter what they tell you, the truth is still out there.